call the Environment and Natural Resources Policy Finance Committee to order. I see a quorum is present. I just want to start off by welcoming everybody to the committee today. We're all glad to be back at it, working for the people of Minnesota. And like all the committees that have been gaveling in for the first time this week, I'd like to start by member introductions. I had a couple of ideas. And I'll start with members. We'll try to keep it tight, though. I see that we have quite a schedule to keep today. Initially, I thought that we'd have plenty of time, but I'm thinking that we're probably going to have some testifiers and some discussion today that will use up our allotment. So what we're going to do is keep it to your district, your name, and then just for fun, some committees have chosen special interests and such. I would suggest, if you would like, to mention your favorite go-to chainsaw and brand, along with those other suggestions. So I will begin with Representative Schultz, if you'd like to lead us off.
Thank you, Mr. Schultz. Chair. I am Representative Isaac Schultz. I represent House District 10B, which includes five counties in central Minnesota. I live in Morrison. I also represent Benton, Mille Lacs, Kanabec, and Isani counties, and I'll go with a steel chainsaw.
Very good. Representative Warwas.
Thank you, Chair. Everyone, I'm Cal Warwas from District 7B, the heart of the Iron Range. Cities like Aurora, Virginia, Chisholm, you've heard of up there, those are in my district. I was raised a Husqvarna guy. I love that Husqvarna saw, but I'm a steel man now.
Representative Nelson.
Representative Nathan Nelson from 11B, so parts of Kanabec, Chisago, and Pine counties. And my go-to is a John Stroud 2159, and
classic.
I just scored the piston on it last week.
Representative Jacob.
Hello, I'm Representative Steve Jacob, District 20B, Rochester, Winona area. So Olmsted County, Winona County, Wabasha County, and parts of Goodhue County. And coming from many years in the forestry business, steel is my go-to saw.
Very good. Representative Gilman.
I'm Dawn Gilman. I represent District 17A, so an hour and 20 minutes west of here. I represent the best over in Wright, Meeker, McLeod, and a sliver of Sibley. And I am a Husqvarna girl all the way, and my husband's got the muscles for it, too. So, thanks.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Chair Heintzman. Representative John Burkle, District 1A, representing Roseau, Kitson, Marshall, Pennington counties in northwest Minnesota. And I'm a steel man as well.
All right, very good. We'll start here on the end. Representative Purcell.
Hi there, Representative Christy Purcell. I represent parts of Rice, Dakota, and Scott counties. And I don't have a favorite chainsaw.
Representative Jordan.
Hi, my name is Sydney Jordan. I use she, her pronouns. I represent Northeast Minneapolis and the part of Como neighborhood between Como Avenue and Hennepin Avenue, and I have a Spensaw.
Very nice. Representative Finke.
Representative Lee Finke, she, her pronouns, from St. Paul, representing some of our surrounding districts, and I do my cutting with estradiol and progesterone.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rick Hansen, South St. Paul, Invergrove, Newport, St. Paul Park, Cottage Grove, and Grey Cloud Island Township. I was steel, but I now have a 20-volt DeWalt electric chainsaw, which is just
very
awesome.
Nice. Love that. Representative Falconer.
Hi, Alex Falconer, 49A, Eden Prairie, Minnetonka area, Husqvarna family, but I do appreciate the Spensaw as well.
Yeah, very good. Lead Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Heintzman. Peter Fisher, represent 44A, which is Little Canada and parts of Maplewood here in the Northeast Metro. My favorite saw is a DeWalt that's on a pole so I can trim my trees.
Very good. And thank you for that. That was fun. We'll now go to staff and Mr. Strodemeyer.
Hi, I'm Peter Strohmeyer. I'm the DFL Committee Administrator for Environment, and I'm a Milwaukee guy.
Very nice. Mr. Yang.
Hello, I'm Legislative Assistant Yang. I'm here for Chair Hinesman, Environment. Don't have a particular stall.
Ms. Peterson.
I'm Casey Peterson, covering the committee today for Amy Zipko. I do not have a favorite stall either.
Mr. Hagemeyer.
I'm Brad Hagemeyer at the House Fiscal Analysis Department, covering the environment and then the legacy committees, and I use a steel chainsaw.
Ms. Taylor.
Janelle Taylor with House Research. I'd say most of my power tools are DeWalt, so I'll just go with DeWalt.
Very good. And I believe we have some pages in the room. If you'd like to stand and introduce yourself. Very nice. All right. And DFL researcher, I think.
See, right?
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Chelsea Graham, DFL researcher, cover the environment and legacy committees. And I have a DeWalt ecosystem at home.
Oh, good stuff. DeWalt. Yeah. And GOP researcher, Aaron Bursey.
Hi, I'm Aaron Bursey. I'm GOP research, and I also belong to the DeWalt family.
All right. No, thank you. That was kind of fun. My go-to, for those wondering, is typically 372 Husqvarna. But recently, when climbing, I've gotten to really like my Milwaukee pruning saw. When you're up in a tree, it's kind of nice to have a lightweight, easy start option. All you do is pull the trigger. It's awesome. So that was great. We're going to go ahead and start moving on. Just wanted to give you all a roadmap for the day. There's, like I said earlier, a lot to cover and very full agenda. I'd like to finish testimony and discussion on our first item on the agenda to stop at about 2. I'm hoping that we can get through everything and hear from all the testifiers that have signed up. That first item is a discussion review on the GTAC recommendations report from DNR. This also, and also the MPCA's recommendations for products containing lead and cadmium. That's going to be a second. So both of these issues will likely have some legislation that might be birthed out of these discussions. So I think it's really important that we have these items on the agenda our very first day of this committee moving forward, and I just thought that it could be helpful, as you know, we're hearing a lot on both these issues. Glad the report is done. And I do want to mention that this is really a first bite at the apple, so yes, there's going to be a lot of questions, but there's going to be other opportunities to get at some of those things if we don't get to absolutely a thorough discussion of every potential issue that might be brought up. There will be chances to address those things going forward. So kind of working backwards from 2:45 adjournment time, we need to allow about an hour and a half for the, about half an hour for the PFAS presentation and testifiers and comments. I'm expecting to add in about 10 to 15 minutes for member comments and questions and get that wrapped up, like I said earlier, at about 2 o'clock. So to keep on schedule, we will hear from the presenters and testifiers and then open it up to member questions. If you want to get on the list, ask a question, please give a little wave and Ms. Peterson will try to get you on the list and we'll take those in the order that they come. So so we'll get rolling. The GTAC report, I again just mentioned, I believe we have Assistant Director, you're going to have to help me with the pronunciation.
Liljegren.
Liljegren. Thank you. You already said your name, but go ahead and reintroduce yourself for the record, and then go ahead and begin your presentation. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks for allowing me to testify today on the Gas Resources Technical Advisory Committee final recommendation report that was delivered to the legislature here in mid-January. again, Mike Liljegren, the Assistant Division Director for DNR Lands and Minerals. Just a quick overview, what we'll be going through, and just something to think about. I'll have it at a number of points throughout the slide presentation, but the Gas Resources Technical Advisory Committee submitted those recommendations and draft legislative language in mid-January. And ultimately, without any legislative action from last year's legislation, if the temporary legislative framework does not pass or does not move through, then what was in last year's legislation continues a moratorium or a prohibition on gas production in the state until rules, final rules, are ultimately adopted. Little bit about how we got there and where we're at today. Ultimately, a high-grade source of helium was accidentally discovered in northeast Minnesota in 2011. While an exploration company was doing exploratory drilling for copper and nickel. That company didn't pursue that potential helium production, so word of this unexpected discovery didn't spread really until 2023, when a company announced plans to drill a helium appraisal well in that same location. And here on the map on the right, you can see the discovery site located, which is southwest of Babbitt. helium potential in the news, and when that announcement was ultimately made, there was a lot of news that spread about the potential for helium in the state, as well as not only helium potential gas, but also geologic hydrogen potential has been on the radar. The state also has a high potential for geologic hydrogen resources, which could be used for clean fuel or green fertilizer. The Mid-Continental Rift system that runs through Minnesota from Lake Superior down to the Iowa border has been identified by the United States Geological Survey as one of the more prospective regions for geologic hydrogen in the country. There's been geologic hydrogen drilling and drill targets in Kansas, Nebraska, and Iowa. You can see that there on the left as on the map, the Mid-Continent Rift there, and you can see those hydrogen targets being drilled in Kansas, Nebraska, and Iowa, and ultimately moving its way to the north. And we know that there's an interest in this move to the north along the rift. Two hydrogen exploration companies have provided input on GTAC's draft recommendations, and next month, there's a company that will be sending researchers to the DNR Drill Core Library in Hibbing that will be ultimately be examining core from Minnesota's portion of the Continent Rift. So you can kind of see on the map there to the right of the U.S. and Minnesota, you can see that in blue from all the way from Superior down as it widens there to the Iowa border is that potential for hydrogen exploration. So ultimately the gas recommendations in the report cover gas in general and not just helium or hydrogen. So ultimately the need for a regulatory framework. Well, ultimately there was no history of gas exploration and development in Minnesota. So there hadn't been the need for those regulations until now. Ultimately, I'll take a step back now just from the enacted legislation from last year. Ultimately, that put a prohibition and a moratorium on gas production without a permit. It created the Technical Advisory Committee, which was led by the DNR, and also had recommendations on permitting underneath a temporary framework prior to rules being adopted. That enacted legislation also had expedited rulemaking for those agencies that had regulatory authority over gas, and it authorized the DNR to lease. So the Gas Resources Technical Advisory Committee, again, directed by the legislature and its membership, ultimately those agencies that were part of the GTAC worked on the recommendations and the draft language that was provided to you in January. Input on the draft recommendations and legislative language from the tribes, stakeholders, and the public. And again, as I said before, that report was turned in January. The GTAC members, ultimately five members that have regulatory authority or taxation on gas would be the Department of Natural Resources, the Environmental Quality Board, Department of Health, Department of Revenue, and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Just quickly going over the GTAC timeline. From the time the legislation was enacted in the end of May of 2024, the GTAC committee was kicked off on July 23rd. And from July 23rd, that group worked on and came up with draft recommendations that were completed in November, mid-November. And then from mid-November through the end of December was tribal and public input period. And then from that input period, all the input that was received was considered and revisions were finalized, and ultimately that draft report was submitted to the legislature again mid-January. Just quickly on the parallel timeline, so you can see what I was just discussing there from GTAC when it was enacted, where we're at today here in February going through. And I just want to highlight again, as I stated earlier, and you can see on here that permitting under a temporary framework, that is only if the legislature acts on that temporary regulatory framework. Otherwise, you would go to not being able to accept any permit applications until expedited rulemaking is done, and a letter of intent to adopt would be the end or May of 2026. So some of the GTAC required recommendations that were enacted in that legislation, you can see the permitting requirements and processes, financial assurance, taxation, boring monitoring, inspection protocols, environmental review, and there were some other topics that were provided in there as other topics as needed. Ultimately, some of the other things you can see here that are highlighted in blue that were added to that is gas well construction, the need if there was for any other environmental permits, and pooling and spacing. So draft legislative language, what did everyone receive, the legislature receive in that draft, those recommendations and legislative report? Some of it is amended existing, amended language from last year's legislative language, and then a fair amount of it is new language in those dark blue bulleted points that we had added. Includes permanent statutes and temporary framework that would ultimately expire once rules are promulgated. So getting into a little bit of the input on the draft recommendations, we ultimately held a 21-day public input period. We had two public meetings, one held in Bowabic and one held in Eagan. And then, as I said earlier, we ultimately took that input that was provided from the tribes, the stakeholders, and the public, and considered, took into consideration that input as we moved forward. And you'll notice in the report, there's a breakdown of those, all of the input that we received and ultimately how we considered those. So what was in the final legislative report? You've heard me talking about that, but just to reiterate, was the ultimate recommendations. Each one of the agencies that sat on the GTAC had their specific recommendations, draft legislative language, because that was part of the legislation from last year, was to provide a full draft legislative language. Also a best practices, regulatory practices report. We have, the GTAC committee had a consultant, gas consultant that worked with us and put together a best practices report, which is in there. I stated the a compilation of all of the input and then how the GTAC considered those themes. So just from a high level, bulleted, I'll walk through the high level recommendations from each one of the agencies. Excuse me, DNR's recommendations. They covered the permitting procedures, siting and setbacks for gas production locations, financial assurance, reclamation requirements, pooling and spacing, as well as an appropriation request. The Department of Health, their recommendations, exploratory borings that encounter gas, licensing requirements, drill rig registration, new rulemaking authority for construction and sealing of gas wells, along with an appropriation request. EQB, recommendations for temporary framework, mandatory EAW for gas resource development projects. Recommendation that DNR serve as the responsible government unit, or the RGU, and require all environmental review notices to include tribal contacts. PCA's recommendations, ultimately their current rules and regulations seem to be sufficient to regulate gas resource development activities under both the temporary and regulatory frameworks, and a recommendation for timely and meaningful consultation between state and tribal governments. And then Department of Revenue's recommendation was ultimately to incorporate gas and oil into existing tax administration laws for mining, apply same exclusions to gas and oil mining companies as other mining companies, create a new structure to allow for different tax rates for each gas, but no specific recommended rate in the recommendations, and add gas and oil revenue distribution to existing statutes, but no specific recommendation distribution model. So ultimately was left up to the legislature on distribution and rate. Through the process, we had a gas production webpage that it will stay up as we move through the rulemaking process. But we have everything that we went through up there now for the GTAC committee, like the legislative report, all the inputs from the tribes, the stakeholders, and the public, our project background, the legislation from last year. And as I said, we will ultimately keep that up and running, and all of our information will be on there as we move through the expedited rulemaking process. So, in summary, similar to the start of the presentation, recommendations have been turned into the legislature, and without legislative action, again, the moratorium and or prohibition will stay into effect if the legislation is the temporary regulatory framework legislation is not passed. If it is, then we would be able to entertain any permit applications following that enactment. And that's all I have. Thank you. I'll stand for questions, and I do have my colleagues here as well from the other agencies that represented the GTAC. So if there are questions outside the DNR, we can bring those folks up. Thank you.
Thank you, Assistant Director Lilligren. Members, I would like, unless there's some protest, I'd like to bring up our next testifier, because I think there might be some questions that are answered. If we need to stop, we can. Otherwise, we can bring people back to get to whatever questions members might have. I'm not seeing anybody waving their hands frantically, so we'll probably come back to director in a few minutes if there's questions. Otherwise, I'm going to go ahead and invite our next testifiers, Peter Larson and Elise Kramer, if they could make their way and introduce themselves for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Larson. I'm from Larkin Hoffman Law Firm. I'm here for Pulsar Helium. I want to tell you that I'm also greeting you on behalf of the principals that you'll hopefully see around the halls. They both are out of state today and couldn't be here. So they look forward to meeting you individually and also being here when there's legislation proposed. So you have a presentation, I think, in your packet that we handed out. I'm going to talk about what's happened over the last few years, plans for the next couple years, and then Ms. Kramer is the expert who's going to talk about some regulatory issues that we've already addressed and maybe answer your questions about how the facility and the work that we've done have been regulated to date in the plan. So if that's okay, Mr. Chair, I'll go forward.
That would be just fine. Thank you. Go ahead.
And I also want to mention the availability for tours. I know Representative Scraba, Senator Hochschild have been at site several times. We've had the St. Louis County folks there. We've had Lake County people there. We've had people in the local communities there. So we stand ready whenever you'd like to go and see what a gas well looks like and what the site looks like. So please just let us know if you'd like to go up there. It's not the best weather right now, but we'll be at this for a while, so we'd love to have you come up and see the site. So I am going to jump right into what we've done to date. I'm going to talk a little bit about future activities, including what's going on in 2025, and then I'm going to talk about our transition from an exploration and appraisal company to a production company, and I'll give you a little bit of sense of time, too, about when these things are going to happen. You see a page like this, and it's got a bunch of stuff that we've done over time. And Mr. Liljegren already talked about the 2011 helium discovery. The principals in this company are experienced worldwide in producing helium. They're very interested in what happened in 2011. And Mike didn't maybe give you all the detail. There was people that were looking for non-ferrous minerals, and they punched a hole in the ground, and a whole bunch of gas came out. The well is named Jetstream because that's what it sounded like. They were worried that it might be explosive. It turned out not to be, but the interesting thing is there was a bunch of helium in it, which didn't really trigger anything for Duluth Metals at the time, but it sure was interesting to people who produce helium around the world. Helium in the U.S. is largely produced as a byproduct of natural gas production, and so this is an unusual situation where we can actually draw it directly out of the ground. In 2011, that's when the Pulsar folks got really interested. They started doing some geophysical work. In 2022, they first really got serious about the project, and they engaged SEH, and Liz is going to talk about the work that was that they were engaged to do starting in 2022. And she's also going to talk about permitting that took place in 2023. 2024, I'll just talk about the wells. So Jetstream 1 was completed in 2024. It's a little over 5,000 feet deep. Jetstream 2 started in January. That will be about 5,000 feet deep when we finish it. And all of that work has been done in cooperation with the Department of Health. They're used to wells. Gas wells are something new for them, and we really appreciate the work that we've been able to do with them to get under a regulatory scheme. Pulsar is a publicly traded company, and I hope you'll find the principals to be very responsible individuals. They really wanted the Department of Health on site to make sure that they were doing the work well. Moving forward, I just have a sheet in here about Minnesota Partners. And by the way, this is a presentation that was just given to the St. Louis County Board. So there have been a lot of presentations up north on this. So there's a list of partners, and what's not on here is Chart Industries from New Prague. Interestingly enough, the place to get your equipment to actually produce helium is in New Prague. So the equipment that's going to be used in the production facility most likely is going to be Minnesota equipment from New Prague. The interesting picture you might like to see is this picture. The company did a couple things. They do passive and active seismic work. And what they do is they try to figure out how vibrations are passing through the land. And this is a representation of what they produce. So there's a couple things they do. One is they put something small, and there's a picture in here, on the ground, and they depend on thunder. North Shore Mining is close by. They do a blasting. There's cars going by, and they can passively measure the vibrations going through the earth just with those small pieces of equipment. They also do active seismic activity, where they actually bring in something that will vibrate on the land and measure it. All very non-intrusive, and they get information like this. And if you look at it and you just see the green, that's what's indicative of probably some gas. And what we're trying to do is figure out how much is there. And we'll probably talk to you about this more, but it's important in this industry to have gas wells so you understand flow and you understand pressure and you understand concentration. So you'll hear more about that, but that's what's happening, and that's what they need to do is figure out what's in those green areas. Moving forward to 2025 activities, again, they already deepened Jetstream 1. They're drilling Jetstream 2. They're doing more geophysical work and more seismic work. In 2024, Pulsar supported the legislation that you guys passed last year. And the reason for that is they have a goal of certainty. They really like to know what is ahead of them in Minnesota. And so they supported the legislation. We appreciate what the agencies have done to this date on the GTAC report. One thing I really want to point out is 2026 work. This is something that we'll discuss, I think, when you see legislation, is we are, again, an appraisal company, not a production company yet. The company thinks they need two or three additional gas wells to understand whether a project is really feasible. And you'll see third quarter 2026 is a final investment decision. And in 2026, that follows a feasibility study. And I point that out because that's when we'll go from being an appraisal company to a company that has the information to actually propose a project that, in our opinion, is what's needed to do an EAW and permitting. And so that's the schedule for that in 2026. So after that, I'll be happy to sit for questions, and Ms. Kramer has a lot of good information for you, so I'll pass it off to her, if that's okay, Mr. Chair.
That'll be just fine. Go ahead, introduce yourself for the record if you have anything. Otherwise, we'll wait on questions. We have one more testifier.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Eliz Kramer, and I would actually like to counter one thing Peter said about site visits. This is the best time because there are no bugs. So I guess that's on the record. I'm Eliz Kramer. I am a principal at SEH. We are a Minnesota company headquartered here in the Twin Cities metro, but I call Duluth home. We are a 100% employee-owned firm of engineers, architects, planners, and scientists. My background with SEH goes back to the start of my career over 27 years ago, working as a field scientist with expertise in wetlands, sensitive species, and natural habitats. I'm certified nationally as a senior professional wetland scientist, and here in Minnesota, I'm a certified Minnesota wetland professional. Along with a degree in biology, I also have a master's degree here from our great state, University of Minnesota. My work with Pulsar Helium goes back to 2022 when they first met with me and my colleagues at SEH. They asked us for our expertise as to what they needed to do to explore here, and we advised them on the kind of site planning and types of regulations applicable depending on their approach and the location of their exploration program in Minnesota. With that, I'm here at the request of Pulsar to describe some key points as to how SEH has assisted them in working through local, state, and federal regulations to implement the exploration phase of their project. Well, first and foremost, and is common to industry exploration practice in Minnesota, and how at SEH we work with our clients in siting infrastructure, we worked with Pulsar to consider ways they could minimize their impacts to the greatest extent possible. As a result of this pre-planning, Pulsar has been able to do exploration with a minimal impacts to the environment and in a minimized footprint for their activity. This resulted in timely and productive reviews from the regulatory agencies that have authority during this phase of this phase of exploration. For example, during the planning stages for exploratory boring activity, we identified a site layout that could avoid sensitive resources. That includes how they access the area of interest and would lay down potential equipment, and ultimately how a one-acre site could be permitted. To satisfy the multiple regulatory requirements for the work to date on both Jetstream 1 and Jetstream 2, those are the names that Peter mentioned of those two exploratory borings that Pulsar has done, they did receive multiple permissions. First and foremost, they worked with the Minnesota Department of Health for an explorer's license and to identify their responsible persons to oversee their exploration program. With that work, they also submitted an application to the MDH for exploratory boring notification, and so that they were in compliance with that agency's exploration requirements. I was involved in particular with the wetland delineation work that Pulsar undertook to make sure that they were going to be avoiding wetland and aquatic resources in their citing their program. And through that, they received a no-loss determination under the Minnesota Wetland Conservation Act. They further pursued permissions through the Clean Water Act with the Corps of Engineers to get a 404 nationwide permit and a transportation regional general permit to access their site. That included water quality certification with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. They continued on to get a construction stormwater permit from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and have continued to follow that compliance work to build their site. Interestingly, they're on private land, but they are centered within the National Forest. So they did work directly with the U.S. Forest to get a special use permit to get access across the forest to their private minerals. And finally, they worked closely with Lake County for their clearing and their grading permits to work on private property. Because of this pre-planning with Pulsar, they have minimized their impacts to the environment, and they've achieved compliance through our existing regulatory programs in our state, locally, the county level, and federally. And that's what has been the extent of their work to date with the importance of this exploration phase. So with that pre-project and pre-development type planning example, I'm here to entertain any questions you might have about what they have done so far. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for your presentation. We are going to go ahead and have the final testifier make their way to the deck, and then stand by, don't go far. So we have Aaron. Aaron, you're going to have to help me with your last name, and go ahead, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed.
Thank you, Charlie. Heinzman, my last name is pronounced Clems, thanks. And I want to thank you and the committee for the opportunity to testify on the Gas Technical Advisory Committee report, or GTAC report. My name is Aaron Clems, and I'm the Chief Strategy Officer at the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, or MCEA. We're a public interest law firm and advocacy organization with a 50-year history of defending Minnesota's environment and the health of its people. MCEA supported the legislation in 2024 that kicked off this process because we recognize the importance of state regulation of this industry and the lack of existing authority. And while the bill has not been introduced by Representative Scraba, I believe, who's going to be carrying the bill, as well as Senator Hochschild, my comments today are in reference to the draft legislation in the final report, because there are a number of comments that were submitted on the draft report that I didn't see any changes reflected on the points that we raised. And I'm aware of also extensive comments filed by at least five tribal governments and several other organizations as well that the DNR considered. I have three main points for the committee today. First, when the legislation is introduced, it should clarify that permits issued have a temporal term and set a maximum temporal term for permits. In the final GTAC report, there's no fixed temporal term for a permit issued to a gas resource development proposal. And this presents a legal problem, as the Minnesota Supreme Court noted in rejecting the permit to mine issued to PolyMet's proposed copper nickel sulfide mine. The proposed language in the legislation should be changed to reflect the Minnesota Supreme Court decision, which called for permits to include, quote, a fixed period of time covering a precise number of years. By requiring a term of, for example, 10 years, there would be a regular period of review for the effectiveness of permit conditions, and the chance to make revisions in response to changing circumstances. Comparable environmental permits issued by the MPCA, for example, have a term of 5 years for water and air permits. My second point is that once permanent rules are established, permits issued under the temporary framework, should the legislature adopt it, should not be grandfathered in perpetuity. The language in the proposed legislation in the report would result in permits issued under the temporary framework remaining valid in perpetuity forever, while standards developed under the rulemaking would not apply to any permits issued during the temporary period. In combination with the lack of a fixed temporal term for the permit and the irrevocable nature of the permits issued, this could incentivize a rush to apply for temporary permits before rules are adopted. It could disincentivize applying for needed permit amendments to preserve a grandfathered temporary permit. It could also lead to slower adoption of permanent rules, since there will not be pressure to complete the rulemaking from the regulated parties. None of these are desirable conditions. There is definitely a need for regulatory certainty, and a reasonable case can be made for a period of time after the adoption of permanent rules for a temporary permittee to receive a permit under those new permanent rules. MCEA recommends replacing "will not expire" once those rules are promulgated with "will expire 3 years after those rules are promulgated," or other term that the committee finds acceptable. Third and last, before this legislation moves forward, the state should engage in meaningful government-to-government consultation with the five tribal governments that submitted comments on the draft GTEC report. I've reviewed these comments and saw little change between the draft and final report in response to them. I strongly encourage the DNR and all those involved, including the legislature, to prioritize this consultation to address the comments of tribal governments. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on the recommendations of the GTAC and the proposed legislation, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Mr. Klentz. Members, if you do have questions for any of the testifiers, we have about 20 minutes, and we should be able to get at those questions now. If anyone wants to start, that would be fine. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Huntsman. Actually, I have a question for the final testifier.
Representative Finke.
Thank you. You said that there were the five, you saw the comments provided by tribal governments that were given in the process and not reflected in the final draft legislation. What kind of recommendations are you talking about that were not taken?
Mr. Clems.
I'm not an expert on all five of those comments. I know they are included on the website that Mr. Lilligan referred to. They were pretty, I just remember the link and the extensive nature of them and not so much the specifics of each of the recommendations made by the government. So I apologize for that.
Representative Finke, follow up.
That's okay for now. Thank you. Thanks.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Chair Heinzman. I have some questions for the DNR.
Mr. Jordan.
Thank you. And so, I just for the committee, can you just talk a little bit about what public land is and who owns it?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jordan, a number of these, if you're asking for specific...
I'm just asking what public land is.
Representative Jordan.
What is public land and who owns public land?
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the people. There's the state of Minnesota on state lands and tax forfeit.
Representative Jordan, follow up.
Yes, thank you. And so I am looking at this, and it does look like there are a number of this language would allow potential gas activities on public land. And if that is the case, I am wondering about some of the language that limits public input on what is being conducted on those lands as part of this draft language. Director. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jordan, there was input, as I stated in my testimony, that GTAC took from the tribes, stakeholders, and public input on the draft recommendations as well as the draft language. We ultimately then, as the GTAC members, reviewed all of that input and considered that.
Representative Jordan, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would the proposal that the DNR is proposing limit public input on that land that you acknowledge that they own?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative, from that standpoint, as we go through on any state land, as that land is leased, any of the tax forfeit land, as that is leased, ultimately there would be a permitting process for gas production if it were to take place on state lands, and that would be a process through permitting that would have input.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Jordan. Were you done? Or? Mr. Chair, is there any plan if you're pumping these gases out that you will be putting carbon dioxide gases in?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I can't answer that question from that standpoint. Right now, everything that is being looked at with these rules and regulations would be gas extraction. There is nothing in the recommendations currently for injection.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, if maybe the other testifiers could answer that question.
Anyone specifically, Representative Hansen? Peter Larson, maybe?
Mr. Larson.
You can.
Looks like there's some debate. We'll just hang on for a second. I will quickly apologize, Representative Jordan. I thought you were wrapped up with your last question. So if we need to revisit that, we can come back to it. Director, was there anybody that wanted to address this?
I was going to say if there's someone from PCA that would like to talk about injection wells.
Representative Hansen, do you have anybody specifically that you would like to come to the desk?
Mr. Chair, I thought, you know, we had these testifiers about the proposal and if there was a plan for injection of carbon dioxide to let us know. I do have a follow-up question about the gases.
Sure. Thank you. Go ahead, Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, so I think I heard and saw in the report, so we have helium and then we have the various noble gases, but there is not a recommended scale for a fee or a tax on those. Just a recommendation that the legislature should set them. Is that correct?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that's correct. Yep, Department of Revenue looked into all of that and what other and did benchmarking, but made no recommendations on distribution or tax rate.
Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, would that be in the jurisdiction of this committee to assign the values to the extraction of the people's helium and other various gases?
I would assume so. We can look more into that. Director, did you have any follow-up? Representative Hansen, it does appear that another testifier has come to the desk that might be able to address your earlier question. So if you'd like to introduce yourself for the record and address the question, or would you like Representative Hansen to maybe restate the question?
Please.
Representative Hansen, if you could restate your previous question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if we're extracting gas, are there any plans to use these wells to inject carbon dioxide from other sources?
If the testifier could please introduce yourself for the record and then answer the question, that'd be great.
Mr. Chair, Patricia Haugen with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. To answer your question, Representative Hansen, there is no, to put carbon back into the ground was not addressed as part of the temporary framework or the GTAC committee. So that is not part of the plan or in the recommendation of the temporary framework.
Representative Hansen, I know that there was other projects that have been discussed in and around that region that did have that in mind. So I think it's a valid question. We should be thinking about that. I think carbon capture makes sense. So I guess if there's more on that, we can address it later. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure which one of our two testifiers can best answer this, but looking at what the process may entail, at what point will it be decided if an EIS is needed for this project versus an EAW, and if you can clue us in a little bit on that timeline.
Looks like we have some folks coming to the desk, but Director, if you want to go ahead, that's fine.
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell. I guess I'll let, now that EQB, I was going to answer that, but I can let Catherine answer that.
If you would please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell. My name is Catherine Neuschler. I'm the Executive Director of the Environmental Quality Board, so we have the authority over the rules for environmental review. What we propose for the temporary framework is that all projects would require an EAW. The end of the EAW process, there's a series of decision criteria that the responsible governmental unit must go through to determine if there is a potential for significant environmental effects. If there is, they are to order an EIS.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So at what point would that be determined one way or the other in where we are in this particular project?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this project hasn't, gone through any environmental review, so that we would go through the whole EAW process, the gathering of the information. We propose DNR would be the RGU, so they would go through and complete the questions in the AW form. There's a public comment period, input is taken, and then it's at the end of that process. The final step is what's called the decision, and so then they make that decision at the end of the EAW process to either say EAW is sufficient or to go forward with an EIS.
Any follow-up, Representative Purcell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One final follow-up. How is that determination made, which government agency is the responsible one, the DNR versus MPCA, for example? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, so within the rules, there's things called mandatory categories. Those are the ones that say they're mandatory review. Review is required for these categories, and those specify the RGU. But in general, sort of the way the program looks at the RGU and that determination is to look at who has the responsibility for overseeing the project as a whole. And so looking at the way things were being recommended by the other agencies and the way we thought this program would work together, the gas development permit that was being proposed by the DNR as part of the temporary recommendations kind of represented that bubble, that umbrella, that overarching permit that speaks to the gas development project very specifically. A lot of other agencies have permits or would have permits under the framework, the recommended temporary framework, and likely under any permanent rules as well. I think the agencies generally do a good job collaborating on things like that, but that's really what we look at, is who has the authority as a whole. So I think it's fairly analogous to the rules for mining as well, where PCA may have a lot of different permits, but the DNR permit to mine is kind of that all-encompassing piece.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question that I have is, if we go through regular rulemaking, what changes in the process to make sure that the tribes are more informed in the process, engaged? I know that as I was reading through the testimony that was provided publicly, there were about 50 pages of comments that were supported by the tribes. And in unity, they were very much disappointed about how they were not really legitimately engaged in the process. And so I'm really concerned about advancing quickly with temporary rules because of that. And so I'm wondering, if we go with the regular process of regular rulemaking, how are we going to address that part of the problem?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher. Working with our tribal liaison at the department, I think as we move forward, we did have a lot of coordination, collaboration with the tribes at our state tribal meetings from the time that legislation was being enacted all the way through the GTAC process. Plus, we did have meetings with all of the tribal leadership. All the 11 recognized tribal governments from Minnesota were on that call, and working with our tribal liaison now as we move forward, whether or not there's a consultation that they would like as we move forward in the rulemaking process.
Lead Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While you've had, as you were mentioning, you had a lot of contact and reach out, it still disturbs me a little bit that every letter that came from that the tribe submitted felt that it was not legitimate, that it felt not listened to. And so I would say, as we're moving forward in the process, that it's something that we change how it's being done, so they make sure that they're felt that they are legitimately engaged in how these rules are being put together. One of the reasons why I have large concerns about trying to advance anything quickly here, as the treaties that cover all of northern Minnesota are rights that we have that we've taken advantage of, but we haven't always protected for our tribal nations, and we need to do a better job of that.
Director, if there was anything there you wanted to respond to, that'd be fine. Otherwise, I do appreciate that the timeline was mentioned, and I'll at the end of this be asking kind of what we're looking at in terms of expected date to potentially have that opportunity. Representative Falconer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the DNR, kind of following up on the tribal questioning. I'm just wondering, and perhaps, you know, I wasn't around the last go-around of this, new on the committee. I'm just wondering the makeup of GTAC, why the tribes are not included as official entity or voice as listed here. Yeah, this is my first question.
Representative Falconer, that's fine. Yep. Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we went off what was in the legislation. And ultimately, the GTAC was chosen on those agencies that have regulatory authority over gas production.
Representative Falconer.
Okay. Well, as has been addressed, there seems to be significant concerns that they perhaps weren't fully listened to, that they still have questions going forward. So I'm just wondering, in the draft proposal language, how much were the tribes consulted before the final document that we have before us is put together? And are you confident that their concerns have been addressed?
Director, I think you've covered that ground a couple times, but go ahead and take another stab at it.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes. And you can, in the report, you'll be able to see, and I think Mr. Clems testified on it, as to how we looked at all the consideration and considered all of the comments. And one of the examples that was taken that was a big concern was siting and setbacks. And you'll notice in the report that taking that consideration and making changes, and a number of other places that we did change those considerations as well.
All right, members, it does look like we're getting close, and it seems as though we may have come to the end of questions. Looking like we're good. So unless there's anything else, I think we're going to move on to our next presentation. Thank you very much for coming and sharing your presentations and your testimony on this report. So as I was just sort of suggesting, we have next MPCA's report on lead, cadmium, and PFAS. I'm looking for Assistant Commissioner Kadalka. If you could start making your way forward, that'd be great. All right. Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. We appreciate that you're here. Good to see you again. It's been a little bit since we last got to visit in committee. So I do have some testifiers on the list as well, and I'll just mention the order that I expect them to come when we do get to that point. Mr. Moran, Mr. Hines, Ms. I think Starrick, and Ms. Strand, so just be on deck and ready. Assistant Commissioner, if you would like to go ahead with your presentation, that would be great.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name's Kirk Adelka. I'm an Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I have a colleague with me too, Peter Sandai, to talk about our report on lead, cadmium, PFAS, and various products. As you may remember, last year the legislature requested a report on four types of products and chemicals. They are PFAS in upholstered furniture related to electronic and other internal components, PFAS in firefighting foams at airport hangars, lead and cadmium in key fobs related to the internal electronic components, and finally, lead in pens and mechanical pencils. Just a little bit of history. These prohibitions were created due to human health and environmental impacts associated with lead, cadmium, and PFAS. To go over some of those impacts, several specific PFAS have been linked to increased risks of cancer, liver disease, immune system dysfunction, and other negative health impacts. And PFAS can also negatively impact aquatic life and wildlife. Lead and cadmium can also cause serious problems for brain health and human development, especially in children. No amount of lead is considered safe in children, and high levels of lead can cause behavioral problems, short attention spans, slower growth, and decreased coordination in children. Cadmium, in turn, can cause vomiting, diarrhea, abdominal pain, muscle aches, and organ damage. Just want to talk a little bit about why those prohibitions were put in place. Many times when we look at these prohibitions, the first thought is that direct exposure, touching or consuming the item and having the chemicals be presented in that way. But there are additional exposure pathways that were important for us to consider when we look at these prohibitions. One is the production of the products released these chemicals into the environment and had the potential to expose not only neighbors but workers around the facilities. The disposal of these products also introduced them to wastewater plants and landfills where they really pose significant challenges. An example is an LCCMR report funded by lottery revenues that showed it would cost $28 billion over the next 20 years to remove PFAS from wastewater and landfill facilities. So due to these issues, we take this very seriously and do not take lightly the potential for time extensions in these areas. Through this process, the MPCA looked at independent research, talked to industry groups and manufacturers. Some we had information already before the report, and some during the report was collected. And you'll notice as we, through the document, the report outlines specific alternatives in various cases, including the type of materials that could be used in its place, and documents conversations with manufacturers and others. It's with this information we arrived at the following recommendations. I'll go over them briefly here. The first is PFAS in upholstered furniture as it relates to electronic and other internal components. There is currently limited available alternatives to PFAS in many electronic and internal components. However, there are alternatives in development as we speak. Examples of PFAS in electronic components include lithium-ion batteries, circuit boards, internal wiring, power cords, and such. Internal components can be ball bearings, lubricants, and other mechanical parts. As the upholstered furniture industry moved forward to comply with the 2025 prohibition, they learned more where PFAS was included in their products in addition to the fabric treatments and others, which we were well aware of their presence. So MPCA recommends an extension until 2032 for the use of intentional added PFAS in electronic and other internal components for upholstered furniture. This exemption would allow manufacturers time to develop and test and implement PFAS-free safe alternatives. Because we also see these same issues in other items in the 11 product categories that are prohibited in 2025, we also recommend an extension for those other 10 categories for electronic components and internal components only. PFAS and firefighting foam in airport hangars. MPCA is aware of 8 hangars that remain that have fixed firefighting systems that use PFAS-containing firefighting foam, all of them owned by Delta Airlines and located here at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. Transition from PFAS-containing firefighting foam is more than just dropping in a different chemical or a different product into a system. It often needs upgrades, and this is the case with hangar-fixed firefighting suppression systems, whether they move to a water-based system or fluoride-free foams, often mentioned as F3. We suggest, after working and researching the issue, establishing a January 1st, 2028 date for airports to transition. That's a 3-year timeline. This would allow the additional work that needs to be done to go through the fire protection process to ensure things such as moving to water does meet the requirements that are needed to provide the fire protection and moves us away from PFAS and firefighting foam. We do also propose the potential for a 1-year extension if additional time is needed. However, we've been told that 3 years should be adequate. Moving to lead and cadmium, we are also asked to look at key fobs and the internal electronic components specifically. Where the issue of lead shows up is lead is in lead solder that's used for the manufacturing and printing of those circuit boards that are located within key fobs. We have found several resources discussing lead-free solder, such as tin copper, tin silver, and tin zinc. Each has alternatives and strengths and some weaknesses that they would have to look at what makes the best fit for their specific situation. But there are alternatives available. They do need a little bit of time to implement those into their key fob boards. So we do agree that additional time should be allowed for the industry to make those changes. Talking to the industry, for instance, the sport equipment industry thought it could take 2 years. As a result, we recommend a 3-year extension for the key industry to implement these changes to lead-free key fobs. Since we see the same issue with lead solder, we do recommend that the other products that are covered under the lead and cadmium law should get similar extensions for 3 years to allow for those changes to lead-free solder. The final item is lead in pens and mechanical pencils. All pen tips contain a tungsten carbide ball that has 2,500 parts per million of lead. The Minnesota law is 90 parts per million. Often this is made with brass, nickel, silver, or stainless steel. High-end mechanical pencils often select metal tips or sleeves that could contain lead. With discussions with the manufacturer of the equipment that makes 90% of the pen tips worldwide, they noted changing to non-lead alternatives was possible, and in our report we list a number of alternatives that are on the market today, and that there are pen manufacturers that are using this in limited situations already. They would need more time to move to a new system, and so we do recommend a 3-year extension to allow pen manufacturers to switch to those lead-free pen tips. Because most of the manufacturers do have some production of lead-free tips, this will just allow for them to build the capacity that we know can be done within, we believe can be done in 3 years to meet the needs here in Minnesota. MPCA doesn't recommend any extension for lead mechanical pencils. And this is due to the existence of alternatives such as plastic mechanical pencils or traditional wood pencils. There is a viable use for writing utensils already available. And so mechanical pencils that may choose to use metal on it could move to other alternatives. And in the meantime, Minnesotans would have access to mechanical pencils. Overall, on all of these extensions, we do also recommend the law require progress reports over the next 6 years for the industries and manufacturers to explain how are they moving forward on these alternatives and to outline their progress to meeting any additional time. Thank you, Chair and committee members. We'll be happy to answer any questions after the rest of the testifiers.
Thank you, Assistant Director. Excuse me, Commissioner Kanelka. Next on the list, I have Mr. Moran. Mr. Moran, if you could introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your comments, that would be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Moran. I'm an attorney here in St. Paul. I am legal counsel for the Writing Instrument Manufacturers Association. We are a trade group that is comprised of several of the major writing instrument manufacturers around the country, around the world, such as BIC, Pentel, Pilot, are a couple of the examples of those entities. I'm here to talk about the recommendations that were made by the MPC and their recent report issued on January 31st. First of all, we appreciate the need for a statute like the statute 325E.3892. We understand the need for that. There are 15 categories of consumer products that are contained within there, within the scope of that statute. The broad category into which pens and mechanical pencils would fit would be the school supply category. And after extensive discussion with the MPCA submissions made last year, as well as meetings, it was determined that a moratorium would be placed on the issue of banning pens under the statute and mechanical pencils under the statute to permit the opportunity to prepare this report. As you can see from the report, There is no assessment of health risk presented by pens or mechanical pencils in commerce in Minnesota, because there is no health risk associated with pens and mechanical pencils for sale and distribution in Minnesota. During the course of our discussions and our dialogue with the MPCA, WIMA, the Writing Instrument Manufacturers Association, submitted multiple studies that were done on this precise issue, because this isn't the first time this issue has come up. It's come up at the federal level in connection with children's products. And there's lead restrictions on the amount of lead that can be put into children's products, and there's a statute and regulatory framework under the Consumer Product Safety Commission. A study was undertaken at that time, and this is going back to 2009 and through 2013, about bioaccessibility to pens for children, lead levels, and risk of exposure to lead to children with regard to pens. And the conclusion was there is no measurable risk to children from pens. I suggest that the call of the statute, the intent of the statute, for which there is virtually no legislative history, the call of the statute is to protect the populace of Minnesota against health risks presented by consumer products. There's a litany of 15 categories of consumer products. I suggest that this was an unintended consequence. When school supplies as a broad category was placed into the statute, pens and mechanical pencils were not contemplated by this. And as a consequence, we have no data, we have no health assessment to conclude that pens and mechanical pencils create a health risk to Minnesota. So by enforcing the statute that is designed to be protecting Minnesotans against health risk, and by banning pens, you are not protecting Minnesotans against a health risk by banning pens. What you are doing is eliminating choice, eliminating options, creating a situation where you're going to have a significant increase in cost of manufacturing, and you're going to have a depletion in the number of or available products in the marketplace. There are 50 million pens sold in Minnesota every year. And what you'll see is a substantial decrease in the sale here, because this is the most comprehensive ban in the country and the only place in the world that would ban pens and mechanical pencils. And as a consequence, we would recommend an exemption. There is, I think, a process being undertaken at this point in time to examine that issue, and legislation is in process. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee, for taking my comments.
Thank you, Mr. Brad. Next up is Mr. Hines, I think. Yep. Mr. Hines, if you could introduce yourself for the record and make your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Patrick Hines with Messerly Kramer, representing the Alliance for Automotive Innovation. Auto Innovators represents automakers that produce most of the new light-duty vehicles sold in the U.S., as well as suppliers and technology and mobility companies. Vehicle keys and key fobs are covered by the lead and cadmium law, and Auto Innovators has taken a deep look into lead and cadmium in the keys and key fobs and provided extensive information to the MPCA as they developed their report. Auto Innovators recommends that banning lead and cadmium in keys and key fobs should not be a high priority, since exposure risk from those items appears to be minimal. With regard to electronic fobs, the lead is in the fobs is in interior components that are not easily accessible. With regard to the minor lead and the brass content of keys, many keys are plated with other metals to change their color, and the brass is expected to be on the interior of the key, not readily accessible. We believe one of the primary flaws in the lead-cadmium statute and the interpretation of the ban is that they have treated all products the same. So fidget spinners and charm bracelets are treated the same as complicated electronic components that are critical to the operation of millions of vehicles in the state. We are pleased that the PCA has taken a small step by acknowledging all products cannot be treated the same and is recommending an extension of the ban's deadline. There are other regulatory structures in place to minimize the exposure risks from keys and automotive fobs, and Minnesota's law is not consistent with those other regulatory structures. As mentioned in the report by the PCA, California's 2001 settlement on lead content in keys effectively brought the lead content of Keys to below 1.5%, low enough so that California's health risk warnings are not required. Additionally, the European Union has directives governing the presence of lead and cadmium in vehicle components, including keys, and sets low thresholds for those substances' use. Auto Innovators recommends that Minnesota consider aligning standards for lead and keys and fobs with these other provisions, which have been in place for many years. Finally, Auto Innovators notes that requiring 6-month progress reports as a condition of granting the 3-year extension is excessive and will not maximize the time spent trying to solve these complicated engineering problems. Auto industry parts like keys and fobs are carefully designed components, and exploration of alternatives will not be a quick process for the industry. If the legislature extends the deadline for the ban as opposed to outright repealing it, we recommend less frequent progress reports, possibly annually, so that the work can continue as aggressively as possible. In conclusion, we believe the amendments to Minnesota's lead and cadmium and keys laws will lead to more effective implementation of the statute and improve workability and feasibility of the law for the industry. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ivana Stark. I'm the State Director of Clean Water Action Minnesota. I'm here today in response to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's report on PFAS, and I want to express my gratitude to the MPCA for their work and appreciation for our continued partnership in the shared mission of protecting Minnesota's environment. Since its passage in 2023, Amara's law has faced relentless attacks from the chemical industry and manufacturers, many claiming the law is unworkable while simultaneously lobbying for carve-outs. A troubling example comes from a small motorsports business in Delano. The general manager shared 2 emails with me, one from Honda, dated December 20th, 2024, and another from Yamaha, dated January 3rd, 2025, just 2 days after the law took effect. These emails acknowledged the new PFAS regulations, but by then it was far too late for retailers to adjust their inventory. These manufacturers were aware of Amara's law by mid-2023, yet they allowed Minnesota businesses to purchase inventory they would not be able to legally sell. This tactic unfairly placed the burden on small businesses, using them as leverage to argue that implementation is too difficult and too costly. This business owner expressed to me that he wanted to comply, but his manufacturers were hindering that process. Minnesota businesses should not be blindsided. This is not a failure of the law, but of industry's refusal to prepare. Now, as Assistant Commissioner Kudelka said, many industries are currently working towards compliance, including Delta Airlines. They and those like them have been true partners in this, and we want to recognize that. Let's not lose sight of why this law exists. A quick reminder, PFAS pose a direct threat to our water and our health. Exposure has been linked to low birth weight, lower IQ, reduced immune response, thyroid disease, digestive issues, cardiovascular disease, cancer, reproductive health problems, including testicular cancer, preeclampsia, infertility, and gestational diabetes. These chemicals bioaccumulate, earning their forever chemical label. And once inside our bodies, they damage our DNA, triggering the health crises I just described. Momentum against using PFAS is growing. The chart on the one pager supplied gives you a snapshot of work being done across the country to tackle this toxic chemical. Internationally, the shift away from PFAS is well underway. Representatives from Japan, England, Australia have all visited Minnesota, inspired by our leadership, seeking to learn more and even replicate our success. As with any legislation, adjustments may be needed as new information emerges, and that's not unusual. That's okay. Clean Water Action supports efforts that strengthen implementation and protect Minnesotans. However, we do urge against future attempts at product-specific carve-outs and exemptions, exemptions without clear time frames, and any attempt to weaken or narrow the impact of this life-saving law. Industries have the power to do this work, and asking for exemptions because it's inconvenient for them to protect Minnesotans isn't acceptable. Minnesota has led the way in the fight against PFAS for our health, our environment, and our future generations. This work must continue to save both lives and tax dollars, and I truly mean it when I say that our door is always open for conversation. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, Ms. Strand. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your comments.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I am Nora Strandy. Many of you know of my older sister, Amara Strandy, who died of cancer days before Amara's law was signed 2 years ago. Since her death, I have followed in my sister's footsteps, advocating for legislation on the insidious chemicals known as PFAS. Over the past few years, I have spoken to many different legislators, both locally and in Washington, D.C., as well as journalists and other community members like me. In the last year alone, I've interned with Clean Water Action Minnesota and the Environmental Working Group in D.C., working on environmental policy and education. I understand that it may be difficult for the industry to use PFAS-free alternatives, but through my work, I have noticed many companies making the switch to safer chemistries. There are products sold that are made without intentionally added PFAS. I've purchased and used some of these products myself, so I can tell you firsthand that not only are these chemistries better for the environment and safer, but they work just as well. I use cosmetics made without PFAS every day, like mascara, lipstick, and even dry shampoo. I also have personal care products made PFAS-free, like dental floss and menstrual products. In our kitchen, my family has a new PFAS-free nonstick cooking pan. The more people that demand PFAS-free alternatives for their products, the more alternatives we will have. This is proof that when we inspire innovation, we get results. For example, Senator Lang and Representative Anderson have put forward a bill for a grant program inspiring innovation around safer PFAS-free alternatives. Minnesota can, should, and will be a leader in this area. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency estimates that it will cost taxpayers between $14 and $28 billion to remove PFAS from wastewater treatment facilities. Industry created the PFAS contamination crisis decades ago and have continued to sell us products using PFAS, and continue to sell us products using PFAS even after years of knowing the harms, health effects, and catastrophic environmental impacts. Therefore, industry can and should be the ones to create the solution. When Amara testified for a law to ban non-essential, intentionally added PFAS in products, she addressed industry specifically, stating, "It is your time to shine." She believed that the great innovators that invented these chemicals could innovate once again for a solution to them. I hold on to that message. Be the solution. Work with us. We want businesses to succeed, just not at the price of our lives. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Strandy. Really appreciate your testimony today. Members, I am going to go ahead and open it up for questions. Representative Finke, you will lead off.
Thank you, Chair Heinzman. I want to thank all of the testifiers who were able to make it today. And I wanted to, I have a couple of thoughts I want to share, and then I have a question at the end for the commissioner. But I just wanted to just level set the idea that we are treating products differently from other products that we heard from our corporate lobbyists that, you know, we're treating pencils differently and pens differently and keys differently. Apparently we're treating Delta Airlines differently. And I think it's important that we recognize that we're not like treating your products differently from other products. We're treating the chemicals all the same. And that's the point of what we're doing. That's what we did with Amara's Law, is to say it's not about what you put it in. It's about what the thing is. And we know that the thing itself kills people, literally, especially children. So the idea that mechanical pencils that have lead in them should be treated differently than other lead products is wrong, because the lead is the point. Lead is the lead. It doesn't matter what you put it in. If it's in the keys, and especially I think it's very interesting that we have keys and pencils, two things that we all know children love to put in their mouths. Well, I don't understand this idea that somehow those products as opposed to children's products. I will tell you that my Keep fob is broken and the inside is on the outside and has been for a long time because it's $400 to replace. We have to treat everything the same. Otherwise, we're not actually solving any of the problems. The last thing I would say on this is that, you know, Ms. Strandy is right that Minnesota, that industry created this problem and industry has to fix it. But I would actually remind us that very specifically, Minnesota industry created this problem. We created these chemicals in the state of Minnesota. And the idea that Minnesota is leading not just the country, but the entire world in regulating products that are killing children, it's actually incredibly good and powerful and inspiring. We are not the outlier in regulation. We are solving a problem that we released upon the world. It is our responsibility to solve it, and it is industry's responsibility to solve it. So I would hope that we do not exempt any of this stuff. And my question is, why are we making an exemption for Delta? If Delta is the reason, if there's only one airline that's not solved this problem, clearly airlines can solve this problem. So why does Delta get an extension?
Assistant Commissioner Kadelka, if you would. Thank you.
Look, Chair and committee members, for the record again, my name is Kirk Kadelka with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thank you for the question. I should have worded that more carefully. They are the only ones currently using those type of systems. There are other hangars throughout the state, but because of the large size of this equipment, it is where it's located. It's more a description of where it's located. Just a little bit on the move away from PFAS in firefighting foam or AFFF. Right now, there's a National Fire Protection Association standard, which requires a number of key milestones and requirements that need to be done moving to new types of systems to provide fire protection. The item that Delta is looking at is actually going to water versus another chemical. And as an agency, we see that as their benefits there, in addition to moving away from PFAS firefighting foam, from moving from other chemicals that may have regrettable solution in the future. As part of that process, there are a number of reports and requirements that need to be done to meet those fire protection pieces. And that's where the three-year process is in place. And they have already started that and have started some of the first phases of that, but it will take more time to complete that action.
Thank you. Representative Finke, follow-up?
Just a quick one. Thank you, Chair. I remember the extensive conversations that we had about firefighting foam when we talked about this bill last year. I'm unmoved by the problem that they seem to have uniquely. I know that everybody has their own unique challenges. We pass a law. It is their responsibility to comply with that law.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Chair Heintzman. And my questions are also for Assistant Commissioner Kadelka. Can you talk, as part of Amara's law, there was an exemption process for a manufacturer to pursue to make a case for their product for why it should continue to be manufactured containing PFAS. Can you talk a little bit about that process and what the Commissioner's office has done in regards to that exemption process?
Commissioner.
Chair and committee members, that is the currently unavoidable use process, which would allow for ability, if for health and safety, that a continuation of a product. That is only for the 2032 prohibition of products with intentionally added PFAS. The law specifically says that cannot be used for the 2025 prohibition. In terms of the implementation for the 2032, we have opened up a rulemaking docket on that. We have had some preliminary conversations and webinars on the issue. However, right now our focus is on the rulemaking for the reporting that goes into effect in 2026, but we will be coming back to that. We have a small team working on those concepts right now for currently unavoidable use.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just kind of to put a finer non-lead point on this. Many producers have been able to make the switch. You know, I get lots of press releases from industry trade groups about how this is a new raincoat from whatever brand that's now PFAS-free, or I get lots of work boot ads that are like, this product has been PFAS-free since whenever they omitted PFAS. So many products have managed to make the switch and are, in fact, advertising that. So it seems a little odd that many products that formerly contained PFAS are now PFAS-free. I think that's a lot of kudos to the people in this room from both sides of the aisle that worked to make sure Amara's Law passed and was a bipartisan bill that passed 2 years ago. And so products and companies are making the switch. They have been successful in that. And I think we need to keep encouraging that and make sure that we do have a PFAS-free future. Thank you.
Mr. Commissioner, I'm not sure I heard a question. Maybe you have something. Representative Hansen, then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Kudelka, are there any efforts at the federal level to preempt states from doing the types of laws that we have passed in Minnesota?
Commissioner.
Chair and committee members, not at this time that we're aware of.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a question for Mr. Hines.
Mr. Hines, if you could reintroduce yourself for the record, go ahead.
Patrick Hines, representing the Alliance for Automotive Innovation.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hines, I'm not sure I heard you correctly, but were you actually recommending that we follow California standards for cars?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that is a very skillfully crafted question. Thank you for it. I was suggesting that California has a standard that is significantly different than Minnesota's, and perhaps Minnesota should look to other states and jurisdictions if it's going to adopt standards that are as low as the ones in this law.
Any follow-up, Representative Hansen?
Mr. Chair, I think we've done that before.
Just scanning the room, members, looking to see if any other members have questions. Not seeing any. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify? I'll just make that available since we do have a few moments left. All right, very good. Members, that concludes today's agenda. So thank you to our testifiers and for the discussion today. Our next meeting will be Thursday, February 13th, and we'll be taking up House File 8. With that, we are adjourned.